seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 040641, DiGiuseppe versus Lawler.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig, please.
May it please the court, Ms. Pendry. I'd like to introduce my colleague, Melissa Prentice. It's an honor to be here today on behalf of Nick DiGiuseppe. Nick DiGiuseppe, through his partnership business entities, contracted to buy real estate at an above-market price, contingent on his ability to obtain zoning acceptable to him. Now, in exchange, he paid $100,000 directly to the property owner, Roger Lawler, and agreed to deposit an additional $100,000 into escrow at a designated time, which he did, and as well agreed to deposit an additional $400,000 when acceptable zoning was approved. These payments were significant consideration. As this court knows from the record, Lawler sued DiGiuseppe to get out of his sale agreement, and he lost. By counterclaim, DiGiuseppe sought to force Lawler to comply with his contract, and the trial court agreed, ordering specific performance. The Court of Appeals erred when it reversed the trial court's judgment for one main reason. We were not required at trial to have to prove we were ready, willing, and able to perform. In the alternative, we are at least entitled to the return of our earnest money. This case presents to the court a very important question for all real estate developers, and as urged by the amicus that has been filed in this court, it gives the court an opportunity to correct a misdirected evolution in the law on specific performance. We are here today to talk about specific performance. In our brief, we discussed the importance of this remedy to the real estate industry, and you're aware that members of that industry have chimed in on that issue. Let me repeat. Here, Nick DiGiuseppe offered Roger Lawler above-market payment for 750 acres in the Frisco area in North Texas in exchange for Lawler's giving Nick DiGiuseppe the option to get acceptable zoning. Importantly, Roger Lawler agreed that if he breached the contract, Nick DiGiuseppe could seek specific performance.
It doesn't say he'd be entitled to specific performance. It says he could seek it.
It certainly says he could seek it.
Which
it
would imply that he would have to prove the elements. Else it would say entitled to. I mean, he didn't stipulate.
Well, I think the argument that they make about the difference between seek and entitlement could be made in any respect, whether you seek or entitled, because specific performance by its nature contains the elements necessary for specific performance. So I think they'd make exactly the same argument whether we had a contract that says your remedy is specific performance or your remedy is to seek specific performance. I think they'd make exactly the same argument. I think it makes no difference to the outcome of this case just because the word seek is used as opposed to some other word. The outcome of this will be determined on what the court determines specific performance means.
Mr. DiGiuseppe moved for directed verdict on specific performance at trial, didn't he? What happened to that motion?
I don't recall what happened. I think they went to the jury on the issues of breach of contract on the directed verdict. But ultimately, the trial court did grant judgment for directed verdict and set up a process, did grant judgment for specific performance and set up a process to have specific performance.
Right, and I'm aware of that. You don't know what happened with the directed verdict at trial?
I believe the directed verdict was overruled, and I think they finished the trial with that.
Was there an order entered, or is it from the bench?
That I don't recall. Okay. I'm not familiar with that.
So there was no finding made by the judge or the jury about the elements of specific performance, but the judgment did say that specific performance was ordered according to procedures in the judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
How did the trial court get there?
My understanding is the trial court relied on this court's opinion in Ponder. See if I've got the right side. It's Burford versus Pounder is the name of the case from 1947, where this court determined that all specific performance is necessary is for there to be a request for specific performance and then leaving it up to the judge to impose whatever conditions the judge needs in the judgment to come through with specific performance. The essence of that case really is what we're saying. If you have the ordinary contract law where another party breaches the contract, then the first party is relieved of having to establish they could have otherwise performed the contract. And you just move forward and say, what is the remedy under the contract? And the remedy here is we're seeking to enforce the contract according to its terms. We're not here to seek money damages from the breach of that. And that's the underlying principle of that particular case of Burford. And the trial judge, I believe, relied on that, looked at that, said...
So if the contract was sell the property and I'll pay you $1 million, and the trial judge orders specific performance, then at that point you would find out whether they were ready, willing, and able?
Yes, Your Honor.
I suppose post-judgment would be you pay, give them the property and you pay them $1 million, and then if they can't come up with $1 million, the trial judge just takes it back, or how does that work?
Your Honor, it would do like the same thing. The judgment could also put in that this has to close within 15 days. You just basically have oversight by the court. I think the amicus does a good job of handling that particular question on the efficiency of the remedy, which really is, even if the court were to say, okay, I come up to the stand and I testify that I'm ready, willing, and able, and the jury finds you're ready, willing, and able, there will be some period of time that happens.
4 years later.
4 years later, final. Something happens. You're no longer able to pay. What do you do with the judgment? And I think amicus handles very carefully. The court is in a better posture to say, I'm going to order specific performance. You all go have a closing in 2 weeks. And if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. And that ends the case. But that problem does not go away just because there's now testimony on that. And, of course, amicus makes another issue. Why would a person who breaches a real estate contract get more rights in the court under specific performance than they'd have under the contract to begin with? As an example, if Nick DiGiuseppe had to, at trial, actually prove ready, willing, and able, what kind of discovery do you have? Well, where's your bank account? Where's your money? Do these people really have the ability to pay? As the amicus makes the point, well, obviously, in the real estate industry, they'll probably make the decision that 24 hours before closing, because the real key is the money has to be delivered at closing, not any other time. And so the efficiency of that issue is really what speaks loudly about why the court in Pounder versus in Burford versus Pounder determined, wait a minute, you know, the other side breached the contract. You are no longer a party that you're harmed by it. No longer have an obligation to satisfy the obligations of your part of the contract. We just move forward if there's a breach, and then the court fashions the remedy. In this case, we sought specific performance.
And there needs to be, however, factual support of each of the elements for specific performance, correct?
That's the question, Your Honor. Under Burford versus Pounder, all that has to be raised is in the pleadings, we seek specific performance. We talk about the elements of specific performance, and we do think the Court of Appeals here got it wrong by requiring evidence of ready, willing, and able. And we say in our brief, you only have a jury decision if there's disputed facts. These parties never disputed ready, willing, and able. These parties always disputed who breached the contract. In our case, Mr. Lawler said Nick DiGiuseppe owed us $400,000. He lost on that. He lost on it. The contract was still viable. We asserted he breached the contract by not bringing good title to closing because he obligated it to D.R. Horton. We won on that. All that was left was specific performance.
I'm interested in your position that specific performance should be a decision that's made by the courts. That seems to make some sense to me. I finally made up my mind, but similarly to... We don't ask juries to determine in a restrictive covenant case, should this garage be torn down or moved, or what should happen to a building that violates a restrictive covenant. I don't think we would ask a jury to make a finding about conduct to be taken by a party. We ask it for a yes or no, or for a date, or for amount of damages, not what's the remedy here, here's four lines of blanks, write in the appropriate remedy. So it seems to make some sense here, but it still needs to be have the elements of what you're asking for, specific performance, there still needs to be some evidence that those elements occurred. And there's a difference between there being some evidence and a jury finding on each element. I think even respondent here acknowledges that there was some evidence. At least your client testified that he was ready, willing, and able to perform under the contract. They may dispute that that was enough evidence, but that there was some evidence on that point. So back to my question a couple of minutes ago, is there some evidence in the record of each of the elements of specific performance?
Well, to the extent that the Court of Appeals is correct, that whoever seeks specific performance must prove that they're ready, willing, and able, then there is some evidence, because Nick DiGiuseppe testified he was ready, willing, and able. Our point is, if that's a requirement, then that has to be a contested issue. There has to be a contest. No, you're not ready, willing, and able in the deal before it even becomes submitted as a jury question. We didn't cite it in our brief, but the court is well aware of Keller versus Wilson, where you talk about the only issues that get submitted to the jury are disputed fact issues. But I think there is another argument here, which is in the remedy aspect of it, it has to be a disputed fact that the jury has to decide in the case that is relevant to the decision-making process. If you're talking about an equitable remedy, as gets mentioned by the amicus here, if you're talking about an equitable remedy, it is virtually irrelevant what at the time of trial a party who's seeking specific performance is capable of doing. Because in truth, what they're capable of doing doesn't have to be set until the time for transferring the property occurs. So it's always going to happen in the future. And the ready, willing, and able under specific performance has to be able to perform at the time the transfer of the property is being called for.
How do you respond?
And even in the trial court, I'm sorry.
The respondent says if we had known that the elements of specific performance were in play in this case, we would have submitted evidence, and that's for a jury finding, that your client didn't have clean hands, for example. And the party seeking specific performance, since that's an equitable remedy, has to have clean hands. So the respondent says we didn't know that was going on. If we had, we would have gotten a jury finding that would have vitiated your right to specific performance. How do you respond to that?
Well, two things, Your Honor. Affirmative defenses are required to be raised in response to pleadings, not what happened during the middle of the trial. The pleadings clearly say we're seeking specific performance. So if they're going to argue, well, we wanted to raise the issue of unclean hands, they should have at the time. But it's also, as we mentioned, it's a bit disingenuous to argue we didn't know specific performance was in play, because that's virtually what the entire case was about. The entire case was saying we wanted specific performance. They said you can't get it because you breached it. We said we can get it because, Mr. Lawler, you breached it. We go to the jury. The jury says, Nick DiGiuseppe, you did not breach the contract. Mr. Lawler, you did. And the judge fashioned the remedy based on the findings of the jury.
A long time has passed. I suppose specific performance is still possible.
Well, it took about a year to clean up the title from his transfer over to D.R. Horton, but we understand the real estate is still there. Of course, that's not in the current record. But obviously, specific performance will require the opportunity either to be able to transfer a good title or to be ready, willing, and able to pay at the time.
And I suppose, since it's an equitable remedy, if you remand it back to the trial court, they could take into account subsequent good faith purchases, what been built on it, things like that.
Yes, Your Honor. Then, in fact, the trial judge did set up a mechanism for proceeding through with the specific performance enforcement, and we assume it'd be remanded to the trial judge to then proceed with how you complete the specific performance award.
So would we, if we agree with you on everything, would we mandate specific performance or remand for the trial court to consider specific performance?
Your Honor, I would say the court would remand the trial court with instruction to proceed with specific performance.
I knew you would say that, but what happens if, in effect, then the trial judge can't make an equitable decision because we've told them what they have to do, right?
It poses an interesting problem, and I thought about it, but I don't believe that's the problem here. If that property is not still in the title of Mr. Lawler, we would have heard about it. And, of course, I assume that if that's the case, he'll raise it. But then again, you'll have circumstances of putting the cloud on title, which is where this case began in the process and why they ended up going to trial.
The $295,000 in damages, what did that consist of? $100,000 was earnest money, right? What was the rest?
This is what is confusing. It was the $100,000 was the second payment of, actually there was a first payment of $100,000 went directly to Mr. Lawler as earnest money to him. There was a second payment of $100,000 in escrow. In the damages section of the case, the first payment of $100,000 went directly to Mr. Lawler, plus $195,000 in expenses for obtaining the different zoning was calculated to come up with the $295,000. But there's no dispute that 100 of that $195,000 was part of the escrow obligation, and then an additional $100,000 still sitting in escrow that the Court of Appeals remanded for. We seek a reversal in rendition, seeking specific performance.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Julian Pendergill, present argument to the respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, I would like to first clear up something about whether specific performance was contested specifically in this case, and then discuss why I believe the amicus and opposing counsel are incorrect on their not only telling you what they believe the current law on specific performance is, but the remedy they would fashion. First of all, specific performance, the elements of it, particularly ready, willing, and able, but all the elements, were extremely in contest. As a matter of fact, though we don't think it was our burden, we disproved it as a matter of law. Two reasons. Mr. DiGiuseppe admitted that he did not have a firm loan commitment. He didn't have the money to close. He admitted that. Also, he did not controvert Lawler's repeated testimony that after planning and zoning approved the, after the planning and zoning issued the approval on the zoning and the $400,000 was due under the contract then, at that point, Mr. DiGiuseppe began trying to change the deal and twice, at least, sent new contracts. It's undisputed that he told Mr. Lawler, I can't make the economics work unless you loan me back $6 million. And he was sending him this revised contract at that point.
Let's take those one at a time. My understanding is that's what the first one is what most developers do. They get an option contract, an option to buy. Nobody's given them money yet, and nobody's going to give them money until the moment of the closing. So the fact that he personally doesn't have the money does not mean, if we say you're not ready, willing, and able unless you got the money in your account, we're not going to have any development in Texas.
No, not asking for that.
Okay. And then the second one, once you enter the contract, and yeah, I'm going to buy it for this and you're going to buy it for that, I would assume it is frequently the case that the both buyer or seller may come back and say, gosh, you know, this deal's terrible. This is going to kill me. Why don't you give me a better deal? And again, if that is enough to say, well, contract's canceled because you're not ready, willing, and able, we're again going to shut down a lot of development in Texas because buyers, sellers always complain about my financial situation and why don't you give me a better deal than we started.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So why is that some evidence that he was not ready, willing, and able? Certainly not evidence as a matter of law.
Well, we weren't saying he had to have the money in his bank account. He had to have loan commitments, or he had to have somebody saying, I'll loan you that much money, and he was essentially saying, I can't find that last $6 million. I want you, Lawler, to loan it to me. Sure, and actually
he was a bit whipsawed too, wasn't he? Because there was a problem with the title at that point. It had been transferred, or there was an issue about who was going to be able to transfer, and nobody's going to loan him the money as long as that's an issue.
No, that had not come up at all. Lawler did not allow D.R. Horton to come in and do the look-see. It's like all these developers do. Let me get it under contract for 10 days and see if I can make it work. He didn't allow that until 6 weeks after DiGiuseppe had failed to come up with that earnest money upon approval of planning and zoning. And as a matter of fact, this is not a Burford situation at all, because Lawler never refused to clear up the title. He was never asked to. Lawler, in fact, tender of the money would not have been futile, as Burford says, because Lawler repeatedly testified as well that, okay, Nick hadn't paid the $400, but he started talking about wanting to come to closing, and I figured if he would show up with the money, I'd close, so I signed this warranty deed. It was a special warranty deed, and he said he didn't know that his lawyer had done something different. He signed that, and he signed a closing statement, and he left it all with the title company before he went out of town. And that's the end of the story. DiGiuseppe doesn't ever say, wait, you need to make that into a general warranty deed. He doesn't ever say, I'm terminating, give me my earnest money back. He doesn't ever say any of that. And none of that problem came up until after Lawler sued for the declaratory judgment to get rid of both of these developers that were just filing memorandums of contract in the deed records to hold the value. So, and that leads to why what they're proposing that this court do is give a legal mechanism to real estate speculators to sort of sue first and find the money later, get it under contract, and in this one, make an illusory promise, because DiGiuseppe also admitted at trial that he knew the way he had done this special handwritten contract could be interpreted that if he made even the slightest change in the original zoning application, he'd never have to put up the $400,000. He knew that. So does this court really want to give the mechanism to these folks to basically ride the float and obviously always have the money 2, 3, 4 years down the road when specific performance is decreed? They're always going to be able to flip the land and thus be ready, willing, and able to bring cash to closing. And as a matter of fact, that actually applies on the flip side too. If you had a seller who was doing the same thing because he had a declining real estate market value, it's going to apply as well. But of course, in this case, it's much more likely what's going to happen. excuse me. I believe that, actually, I understand now, I think, why the court granted the case, because the jurisprudence on specific performance is pretty darn murky.
Well, let's talk about that specifically.
Okay.
You believe that there must be a jury finding, or must have been a jury finding in this case, for specific performance to be properly awarded?
I believe there has to be a fact finding on all those elements. And you shouldn't be allowed to bait and switch the jury, which is what they did, or to cherry-pick what facts you ask the jury and what you ask the judge. Because in this case, they decide not to ask for specific performance elements in the jury charge, very, very possibly because they know the jury is not going to take Mr. Lawler's farm away from him, given what all went down. So you ask the jury, did Lawler fail to comply? And they say, yeah. And the jury there knows that they can, the remedy for that, the next question is, if so, how much money? And they give him back what DiGiuseppe testified he had in the deal, which, granted, he specifically waived in the contract his right to money damages. But, okay, but you tell a jury, if you find Lawler breached, here's what you give him. And then suddenly you turn around to the court and you say, but we want you to just sort of impliedly find that, oh, yeah, he could have had the money, and, oh, yeah, it was a contract free from misrepresentation, surprise, mistake, misunderstanding, or imply that I had clean hands, or, as a matter of fact, the trial court would have even had to imply that DiGiuseppe complied with all the terms of the contract. That's the first and foremost.
So you agree, then, it sounds like, that we don't give the jury an exam booklet and say, write in the appropriate remedy in this case.
Oh,
we have the jury make specific, fairly well-defined determinations with appropriate guidance. Specific, perhaps novel, equitable remedies should be left to the judge. You agree with that?
Sure. And it's extraordinary relief. It's equitable relief.
But you don't dispute that there's evidence submitted on both sides of each of the elements of specific performance. Sounds like you're saying the jury didn't get a chance to say, we believe you on this, but we don't believe you on that, therefore we're going to find no clean hands, and decide which of these elements that they believe your opponent versus your client. The jury didn't get a chance to make that choice.
Correct,
that
but I wouldn't take it as far as you say in this particular case. The evidence on DiGiuseppe's side is simply him saying, oh, yeah, well, no, I was short the money, and no, I didn't have firm commitments, but I could have got the money. That's the evidence of ready, willing, and able. And
that's what it'll always be, though, right?
No. No, it needs to be a little something more. It certainly needs to be his burden to prove, as opposed to the fact that we sustained a burden to disprove. He never controverted that he didn't have $6 million of it. He was short $6 million.
Right, but no developers never put up much of their own money.
Oh, he probably never puts a dime in anything.
That's how you get rich. You don't get rich
sure.
spending your own money. If that's not enough, we're not ever going to have. If they have to prove that they got the money before closing, and this is a deal that fell apart by definition, because you only get to this if the seller prior material breach. How are they? So they're going to have the deal fall apart, then go to their investors the day of closing and say, "I need to have the money, something signed by you." What?
The deal really didn't. Fall apart. Yeah, but aside from
but
those
it will.
Facts,
I mean that's
right.
going to be the.
No, if you have a, you're going to have financing of I'll give you $6 million of that and $10 million of that, assuming you close the deal. And obviously, if you get to closing and you ask him to give you a general warranty deed instead of that special deed,
right?
And he can't.
And
do
that makes it easy if you've had
sure.
it. If you but the. If in the case that's going to be specific performance, there was a prior material breach by the seller. Otherwise, we don't get to the specific performance question, which means in many cases the prior material breach by the seller, we don't end up going to closing because the seller sold to somebody else or the seller's canceled, sent a letter canceling the deed. How other than the buyer saying, I would have had the financing, are you going to prove that?
Well, you don't have a prior material breach here. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen.
That's what the jury. That's what the
no.
jury finding was.
Well, actually, on both of them, the jury finding was that Lawler failed to comply. And actually, the Court of Appeals doesn't go into that at all. They don't have to talk about whether he breached or didn't breach, or whether the court interpreted the contract correctly, because DiGiuseppe doesn't perfect an appeal on the other kind of damages. It's only on the specific performance. So, you know, that may be a little nicety there, but actually the Court of Appeals didn't even discuss contract breach.
Well, what we're stuck with is who breached, and the jury said your guy did.
Okay, and the jury said my guy did not comply. The jury said he said DiGiuseppe didn't fail to comply. That doesn't even get DiGiuseppe past the first element of specific performance. He doesn't even get to ready, willing, and able because he hasn't proved that he did comply. It's a Campbell versus CT Transport kind of thing. The jury's failure to find on our cause of action, failure to find that he didn't comply, is not a finding that he did comply on his own cause of action. So he's not sustaining the burden. And clearly, if you're saying that, simply saying in a pleading.
I'm not a real estate expert. If the seller breaches 2 weeks before the closing by sending a letter saying, sorry, I've sold it somebody else, the buyer still has to go to trial and prove that they complied with the contract? They don't have to do that on any other kind of contract.
Not that they complied. That's the separate. Well, they have to show that they, yes, they have to show the basic elements of I complied with the contract. That's part of equity. Am I entitled to get more than
on every other area of contract law, and maybe real estate's different, whoever the first prior material breach, in fact, that's what, prior material breach excuses any subsequent breaches.
I agree with that. If we're not talking.
So it doesn't matter. Once there's a prior material breach, it doesn't matter whether you complied or not after that. You get the right to sue, right?
Right. You need to, but you need to have proved that you were, and this is not separately, I mean, clean, unclean hands is separate, but this is first time. You need to have proved that you had done everything you were supposed to do. Then you have to prove that you could have closed the contract. You're not just using this as speculation to tie things up. This is...
Ms. Pendry, was there an objection to the failure to submit a different question? For example, question number two says, did Giuseppe fail to comply with the contract? You said that was yours on his breach. Was there an objection that he failed, that there was a failure to submit an affirmative finding or an affirmative question on him with a burden of proof on him that he failed to comply?
No, I'm just saying.
Then the question I have is this. Is that not a shade of a question as to the first element that you've listed in your brief, that he complied with all terms of the contract? Is that not a shade of that in some manner?
I don't believe it is. First of all, a jury's declining to find someone failed to comply with the contract is not a finding that they did comply.
Burden of proof switched, I understand that.
Right.
But if the trial court were to take it that way, at some point the trial court's entitled to have deemed findings and things, and that's why I was asking about the objection. There was none.
No. And hey, this case was... It's maybe not the best case for you to write on because it's poorly tried, poorly submitted, poorly pleaded, etc. And it's got odd facts and what have you. But that was our issue. That was not his issue. And I don't think that you can pull out of...
We call them your issues and his issues, but the fact of the matter is it's the court's charge.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, what can the court do pursuant to these findings by the jury?
Well, the court cannot supply or imply into that finding as much as they would have you imply into it. You are back to a burden of proof issue, or you are back to a, you know, is that the plaintiff's issue, is that the defendant's issue? I'm sure you can think of some instances in which, by implication, an answer to one supplies something, but this isn't it.
On another note, it seemed to me that DiGiuseppe was satisfied with the specific performance judgment in the end. So why do you say that in order to complain now about the refund of the earnest money, they had to perfect an appeal on that?
Well, interestingly, they never asked for the earnest money back because the contract language, again, DiGiuseppe's thing, gives, all right, a remedy if Lawler breaches is DiGiuseppe can choose between immediately terminating and getting the earnest money back or seeking specific performance. He does not terminate. He doesn't ask for it back because he said, I don't have a dime of my money in this. He's going to, you know, ride the 4 or 5 years it takes
but
to get
here. But you said he's waived even the right to argue for the earnest money.
Sure.
Because
but,
he didn't perfect it. Right.
Right. And because it is confusing. You've got Justice Wainwright has this right. It is confusing though because what they're asking for in the Court of Appeals, what they were asking the jury for, what everything they had was the money damages, which they specifically waived in the contract, but and not the earnest money. So the first time they ever asked for the earnest money is on motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals, and that's why the Court of Appeals is saying, ooh, that's a little late. It certainly wasn't anything that was ever presented to the jury. And it's not one of those alternative things that's in a finding included in the judgment. The money damages aren't even included in there.
I'm a little confused about that point that the Chief raises. The record includes, filed April 29th, DiGiuseppe's and Frisco's notice of appeal. And it includes, dated May 13th, order issued May 13th, 2003, the Court of Appeals order granting appellee's motion and determining that the notice of cross-appeal filed with the trial court on April 29, 2003 is deemed timely filed. Maybe you want to brief this in some supplemental briefing, but it looks like there's a notice of appeal in the record and an order by the Court of Appeals that it was timely filed.
Yeah, I probably do want to brief that because that's something that...
Because that changes the nature of that
beast.
It might,
depending. Although, again, the earnest money doesn't ever come up.
Well, it changes the nature of the waiver beast, at least.
If those
look like they're in our record.
It might. I was not even aware of those, based on, I believe, the Court of Appeals opinion. But also, in all of your cases where you have that instance of what you can pull back in or go back to and take alternatively, you're looking at things that were included in the judgment. And, in fact, this judge had to, on his own motion, disregard the finding of the money damages, which includes 100 of the earnest money, in order to get to where he even found a specific performance. So, anyway, that I will brief in post-submission. But I think we need to get back to who would have the burden of proof. We need to look at who's asking for what extraordinary remedy and be cautious of giving developers who play these games for a business the opportunity to, as I say, file suit first, find the money later, keep the property tied up, play the float till they can flip it at a tidy profit.
Thank you.
We ask for nothing.
The Court's permission, just a few comments on rebuttal. First of all, I understand that Ms. Lawler has distributed a timeline of pertinent events. I think it's obvious when you read it that their timeline of events are written according to their version of the facts, but it's not particularly labeled, so I just want to call your attention that it is their timeline that they've submitted. As the Court saw in the response, as we've also said in our briefing, all the response really goes to the merits of whether they breached the contract. Mr. Lawler did. The jury said that they did, so we're beyond that. I would like to point out to the Court that the trial judges in equitable circumstances often craft the remedy. Injunctions, as an example, are often crafted by the trial judge on what events will happen, what we will set up as a way of determining whether there's violations of the order. This is no different. If the equitable remedy is specific performance, the trial judges would craft whatever that remedy would look like, however their judgment would come. I'd like to follow up on a couple of things. Allocation of risk. Let's talk about allocation of risk. Mr. DiGiuseppe offered higher than market value for this property in exchange for the opportunity to work on zoning. We all know that zoning affects the value of property. So what happens when we're encouraged, as the record will show, we're encouraged to continue working on zoning throughout the process, all the while Mr. Lawler's gone, and now for that value of the property has given it under contract to somebody else, all the while encouraging us to continue working on zoning. Who's the one who keeps the value of the property after the work has been done? But we're not really here arguing about that. What I wanted to finish on was really the policy, and it's something that I truthfully had not focused on until I saw the amicus brief come in, and that's the policy about the remedies of specific performance. It is not helpful as a jurisprudential matter to require a party who was not the breaching party to come forward and prove they could comply with the contract as their burden for specific performance. As an example, specific performance will necessarily be in the future after the Court's ruling, and it is only then that they're required to be able to perform. The Court can more efficiently craft a remedy. As an example, you must perform by X date in order to get that remedy, than to say, are you ready, willing, and able today to perform, and then having final judgment, and then 5 days afterwards, they're not able to perform. So as a matter of policy, it's a more efficient process jurisprudentially to have the Court designate how the specific performance will apply.
Let me ask you real quickly. I'm confused on question number 6 about money damages. It seems like the contract says you can either get your earnest money back or seek to enforce specific performance.
Yes.
And yet we've got a jury question on damages for 295, 696, 32. What are we to do with that? I mean, if the court were to determine that specific performance should have gone to the jury, what happens?
We've asked for return of the earnest money, which is $200,000.
But, I mean, that wasn't sought before the jury. We would just...
That's correct. Your Honor, on the earnest money, there was no dispute how much that earnest money was. It was $200,000. That's not really... I mean, that's just not anything anybody's argued about. In the trial court, obviously Mr. DiGiuseppe's attorneys thought if Mr. Lawler is going to take away the only valuable right we have, which is specific performance, then by God, we're going to come after damages. But all the parties can see the damages...
We don't have the authority to what would we do? What would our disposition be? Remand to the trial court for entry of judgment for return of earnest money in accordance with the contract? Is that what it would be?
If the alternative was to simply return the earnest money, we've asked for that in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said we waived it. We've asked for that here as an alternative. There is no dispute that $200,000 was paid. They concede $200,000 was paid as the escrow. And so we would seek that, if that, in the alternative for the $200,000. I think the court would have no difficulty coming to that kind of judgment out of this court without even remanding to the trial court.
Well, it's clear that your client asked for at least $100,000 of the earnest money at the trial court because $100,000 was awarded. What about the other $100,000? Was it asked for at the trial court?
Your Honor, it was not asked for at the trial court, but on the other hand, we asked for specific performance. We elected our remedy. We did not lose our remedy of specific performance until it got to the Court of Appeals, and this court has been clear that we have no obligation to seek a review of the trial court's judgment that gives us our return.
I guess where I'm confused, though, is the contract said that you could terminate the contract and receive a refund. And you didn't terminate the contract. So would there not be a question as to whether you're entitled to a refund? Refund seems to be contingent upon terminating, and that didn't happen.
I may be mistaken, and my memory may not be clear on it. I understood that in the event of seller's breach, the purchaser has the option of requesting return of the earnest money or specific performance. And I may not be remembering that, but that was a particular question I looked at, and I think they were alternative remedies in the event of seller's breach. And in this case, of course, we have a jury finding of seller breach.
Any further questions?
One other. Counsel, are you going to submit something supplementally addressing the notice of appeal waiver point as well?
I'll look forward to it. I think I win on the law anyway, but I look forward to doing that.
Okay.
Thank you. The cause is submitted. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.